ratify a strike 3 months later over the same issues, though that strike was averted when nurses voted to ratify a new contract that the union said would prevent reductions in staffing. Amid the pandemic, healthcare workers have been under increasing stress and have quit their jobs in record numbers. This has led to increased labor activity out of the 20 strikes recorded by the Department of Labor, which only records the strikes larger than 1,000 workers last year. Four of them were nurses' strikes. In 2021, meanwhile, Cornell University researchers found healthcare and social assistance workers made up over half of all workers involved in work stoppages in 2021. Meanwhile, Guardian reported hospital managers have criticized nurses for refusing an offer and accused workers of abandoning patients. In a statement to CNN, a Mount Sinai spokesperson, Lucia Lee, said NYSNA leadership walked out of negotiations shortly after 1 a.m. ET, refusing to accept the exact same 19.1% increased wage offer agreed to by eight other hospitals, including two other Mount Sinai Health System campuses, and disregarding the governor's solution to avoid a strike. Citing the 19.1% increase, a statement from Montefiore Medical Center accused union leaders of walking away from the bedsides of their patients. Nurses say the decision to strike came after Mount Sinai and Montefiore failed to take negotiations seriously. Their behavior at the negotiating table mimics the behavior they show us on the units every day, said Matt Allen, 37, a labor and delivery nurse, adding, "They have been dismissive. They have been disrespectful. They ignore us. They are blaming us for abandoning patients and being irresponsible. But the hospital has been abandoning patients for the past several years when they refuse to give us adequate staffing."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British royal family may appear to be prim and proper to the public. However, they have faced their fair share of controversies over the years. From the separation of Charles and Diana in 1992, and the famous comment of the late Princess of Wales that there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded, to the Megxit when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepped down from their royal duties. Now, few years into the new year, the royals are on the back foot. The Duke of Sussex's tell-all memoir, with its bombshell revelations, has turned into a big challenge for the monarchy. Prior to the official publishing of the book, multiple media outlets reported they had secured copies of Harry's autobiography. Among the jaw-dropping claims is Harry's reported retelling of his scuffle with his brother, Prince William, in 2019, his use of cocaine as a teenager, and killing 25 people in Afghanistan when he was a helicopter pilot in the country. He also said he confronted discrimination and neglect from the royal household from a younger age. While Buckingham Palace has kept silent, Harry's revelations have drawn mixed reactions. Some have denounced Prince Harry's tell-all memoir for putting family arguments out there for the world to see. They say Harry's account will be damaging to the monarchy and undermines the king at a time when he is trying to show the institution is modernizing. Others say they sympathize with the sibling rivalry the prince describes and other elements of his experience. The fact is, the British monarchy is by its very nature hierarchical, and this has led to Harry feeling like his spare part. A former royal biographer has said he is perplexed by Harry's memoirs, saying it contains the kind of revelations you would expect from a B-list celebrity. Meanwhile, the royal analyst and biographer of King Charles, Catherine Mayer, has said Prince Harry's book could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, given the lack of trust in the state at the moment. She said anger over racism, misogyny, and wealth in the royal family can undermine public consent for a monarchy. Survey results over the years show that younger people are less likely than older people to say that it is important that Britain has a monarchy. Indeed, just 14% of under 35-year-olds take that view compared with 44% of those aged 55 and over. This suggests support for monarchy will decline as today's older generation is replaced by younger Britons. Revelations in Prince Harry's newly published book include the murder of 25 people in Afghanistan while serving with the British Army in the country. The 38-year-old described killing targets as moving chess pieces, noting that he was not ashamed of doing so. High-profile British veterans have criticized Prince Harry and warned the high-profile admission could increase the risk to his personal security. Retired Army veteran Colonel Tim Collins said the prince's kill count talk was crass, and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Others said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize those he killed by describing them as chess pieces removed from the board. That's while the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion preceded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
The United States has yet again imposed a fresh round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, this time targeting the country's suppliers of drones Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Kos Aviation Industries. The U.S. Department of Treasury said the group, which has been under U.S. sanctions since 2013, was a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. Washington said the drones have been used to target civilian infrastructure in Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. Among those designated was Sayed Hojatollah Qureshi, Quds Aviation Industries board chairman and senior official in Iran's Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics. The Treasury said Qureshi had led Iran's military research and development efforts and was responsible for negotiating Iran's agreement with Russia for the supply of the Iranian drones for the war in Ukraine. The Treasury also imposed sanctions on Qasem Damovandian, Quds Aviation Industries' managing director and board member. It said he had likely facilitated the group's supply of drones to Iran's military services and the training of Russian personnel on the use of drones. The accusations come as Iranian officials say Ukrainians have so far failed to provide any evidence for their claim that Russia was using Iranian drones in its war on Ukraine. Speaking following a technical meeting between Ukrainian and Iranian experts, Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, said the Ukrainian side had stopped short of presenting any evidence of Russia's use of Iranian drones in its war in Ukraine. Prior to that, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had also reacted to the U.S. and other Western countries' allegations, noting that Tehran had provided Moscow with a limited number of drones, but the delivery had taken place months before the war in Ukraine. The sanctions come as the U.S. Treasury says it will continue to use every tool at its disposal to deny Russian President Vladimir Putin the weapons he is using to wage his unprovoked war in Ukraine. The Friday sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization, which the Treasury claimed was the key organization responsible for overseeing Iran's ballistic missile programs. The move freezes any U.S. assets of those designated and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. Those engaged in certain transactions with the targeted individuals also risk being hit by sanctions. The United States has previously imposed sanctions on companies and people it accused of producing or transferring Iranian drones that Russia has used to attack infrastructure in Ukraine. Military-related sanctions on Iran are just a small part of the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Washington has left no stone unturned in pressuring Tehran to fulfill its demands, given that the so-called maximum pressure policy has so far failed to produce the intended result. It is widely believed that by pressuring the government and subsequently the people of Iran, what the United States is and has been pursuing after 40 years of the Islamic Revolution is seeking regime change. The sanctions against Iran over the supply of drones to Ukraine comes as the West has itself been fanning the flames of the Ukraine war by providing billions of dollars worth of military assistance to Kiev. That includes the United States, Germany, France, and the UK. The weapons they provide range from mortar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks like AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles and Abrams tanks. This is while providing Kiev with such weaponry could increase the risk of direct confrontation between Moscow and the West. Iran has been under the UN and US sanctions since the 1979 revolution. What comes to the spotlight is the futility of such all-out anti-Tehran measures. Despite 40 years of pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Republic, not only Iran has not stopped, but it has progressed, so the sanctions tactic has lost its effectiveness in a sense. This rather indicates that the United States seems to be escaping the frustration caused by its failure against the Iranian nation's iron will. The resilience of Iran's economy is not the only reason why the unlawful American maximum pressure campaign of sanctions against Tehran has failed. The maximum pressure policy against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Donald Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to strike a better agreement, which he hoped would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Eventually, his hopes and aspirations became more and more far-fetched with each passing day. Now the Trump-imposed sanctions regime has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. Could this be because they see no alternative course of action? What seems to be of very high significance is the fact that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only didn't work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena. Yet Iran stands. How so? Iran's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives to circumvent such U.S. measures.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense ministers' meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2022 because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرج.
Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. I really welcome you all. Here again, we have some of the students of Sevier International Schools, Brother Fawad Haider, Brother Hassan Nasrullah, and Hussein Ruhullah. So, I really welcome you all. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. How
are you? Fine?
Yes.
Yes, Fawad? Hassan?
Yes.
Okay, alhamdulillah. So today, the same as our previous sessions, inshallah, two of the verses of Surah Al-Baqarah on page 39, the last two verses of page 39. Inshallah, we'll practice, we'll have a short explanation, plus the tajweed rules, the important ones. So, brothers and sisters, I really want you to hold your Quran, turn to page 39, ayah 244. And 245 of Surah Al-Baqarah. Before we start, let's everyone listen to the recitation of these two verses.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وقاتلوا في سبيل الله واعلموا أن الله سميع عليم. من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له أضعافا كثيرة والله يقبض ويبسط وإليه ترجعون.
That was nice. Make sure, inshallah, you listen carefully now. I will be reciting Fawad, Hassan, and Hussein, and also our brothers and sisters who are listening to us. So I will recite. Make sure you listen carefully and repeat. Okay?
Yes.
Right? أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
وقاتلوا في سبيل الله واعلموا أن الله سميع عليم.
وقاتلوا في سبيل الله واعلموا أن الله سميع عليم.
من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له أضعافا كثيرة
من ذا الذي يقرض الله قرضا حسنا فيضاعفه له أضعافا كثيرة
والله يقبض ويبسط وإليه ترجعون
والله يقبض ويبسط وإليه ترجعون
أحسنتم ما شاء الله Thank you so much Allah bless you إن شاء الله وقاتلوا في سبيل الله واعلموا أن الله سميع عليم Fight in the way of Allah and know, and you should know that Allah Almighty is all hearing and all knowing. Guys, sometimes people try to fight against others, okay, and they're claiming that we're fighting for the sake of Allah Almighty, okay, in the name of jihad that we have. Some terrorist groups, okay, these days, in the name of Islam, so they are trying to fight with others, okay. Conquering the countries, for example, they are claiming that we are doing jihad, but in fact, it's not jihad, right? In fact, it is terrorizing others, okay? Terrorism. So, وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ Jihad you have to do. Jihad has certain conditions, okay? There, nowadays, there should be an imam, by the command of an imam, Under the or with the army of the imam, we have to do jihad, fight with others, okay? But nowadays, imam is in ghaiba, in great occultation, so we don't have the permission to go to other countries and fight, okay? Except we have the defensive one these days. If other people, terrorists, okay, if they are trying to terrorize our countries or any of, for example, Islamic cultural and Islamic values, okay, of course we need to defend. Like we defend, like what? In Syria. So they are trying to terrorize the Holy Shrine of Lady Zainab and other Muslims. We need to defend. Alright? So, this is not called terrorist, okay, that we defend. But actually, what they do is called terrorism. Okay. Now, there are certain conditions for the jihad, okay? Inshallah, you can refer to the Tafasir book. Inshallah, you can have the explanation there. Man the levy, next ayah tells you an important point. It talks about loan. Do you know about loan?
Yes. Qarub.
Which means like you lend someone who needs, someone who asks you about, say, like give them some money, yes? You should lend them if you have. Okay? So it's so good. Look, Allah Almighty says, Man the levy yuqridu Allaha qardan hasanan. Allah Almighty says, if you give, If you lend someone, a needy person, the one who needs some money, okay, to do something. So if you give him, your Muslim brother, if you lend him some money, and if you solve a problem from him, okay, this is as if you have lent Allah Almighty. You've given a loan to Allah Almighty, okay? It has a lot of thawab, okay? So it says that you have to try to solve the problems of your Muslim brothers, okay? إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَةً We are brothers and we have to help each other, okay? This is an important thing. If you do so, Hassan, if you lend someone, فَيُضَاعِفَهُ لَهُ أَضْعَافًا كَثِيرًا Allah Almighty will double it for you. The Hassanah, okay? There are certain conditions also for a person to lend, okay? And yeah. وَاللَّهُ يَقْبِضُ وَيَبْسُطُ Allah Almighty is the one who increases, who decreases, okay? The hasanat, the good things, the rewards. So, وَإِلَيْهِ تُرْجَعُونَ We will return to Allah Almighty. The important point was this, that if someone asks you, and you know that he needs money, for example, lend him if you have, okay? Then, inshallah, for the certain time, you should ask him, and he has to pay back. Yes?
So, if you give some money to a person, mm-hmm. like an amount.
Yes.
Allah will exactly double it.
Will double it. Allah Almighty doesn't, for example, you give him like $10, okay, lend $10, so Allah Almighty will not give you $20, okay? It doesn't mean this, the reward, the hasana, okay? That inshallah you will gain, actually, there are sometimes, okay, you gain a lot of money.
It's sawab is doubled or?
Sawab is also doubled, both in this dunya and akhirat also. Look, sometimes you gain a lot of money from different places and you don't exactly expect those money. Sometimes you get some money and you've never expected those money, okay? The money, yes? This is one of the example of فَيُضَاعِفَهُ لَهُ أَضْعَافًا كَثِيرًا. Sometimes, okay? So I want you to refer to the Tafasir book, inshallah, for explanation more on these two verses.
IRIB English Radio, in cooperation with Xavier International Schools, presents Let's Recite the Quran.
Now, the very, very important tajweed rules, inshallah, will mention. وَقَاتِلُوا قَاتِلُوا. Here, a heavy sound with the letter قَاف. فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ سَمِيعٌ عَلِيمٌ. Three important points I want to mention here. The first one is that you have to skip Hamzatul Wasl. It's easy. You have to know. Okay, so the first rule is the mad here, wa'lamu Hussein. Do you think this mad is wajib?
No.
No, it's not wajib, yes?
Yes.
It's not mandatory. So you can skip the mad. Wa'lamu, or skip it. Wa'lamu anna Allah. What was the rule?
For what? If Hamza and the mad are in the same letter.
In the same word.
Yeah, in the same word.
So
in the same word, so the mad is wajib.
Wajib.
But if not, it's
jais. Munfasil. So jais, thank you. Yeah, that's the rule. That's the rule. Look at the harful mad. We have three harful mad. Huruful mad. Alif, waw, ya. If you see these letters with a fatha kasra dhamma before of them, yes? Of course. Like plus Hamza, here a mad is applied. But sometimes this mad is wajib, sometimes it is not wajib, it is ja'iz. So wajib, we mean it is obligatory. You have to stretch the sound for six counts. Wa'alamu, for example, six counts. If the mad, the harful mad, alif, waw, ya, and Hamza, if they are not in the same word, if they are in two separate words, it means it's not obligatory for you to stretch the sound for six counts. Okay, you can do it or skip it. Or stretch it for three counts, four counts, no problem. وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ. Second rule here, second point, is about the pronunciation of the letter la. Heavily, yes? Because, Hussein, what is the rule, Hassan? There is, before the word Allah, there is a fatha sound. If there is a fatha sound or a dhamma sound, a or u sound, you have to pronounce the letter lam in the word Allah and the word Allahumma heavily, with a heavy sound. An-Allaha. But if there is a kasra sound, lightly. Bismillahi, a flat sound. Bismillahi, a'udhu billahi, right? That's the second rule, second point. The third point is about the tanween on the word sami'un, tanween plus ayn. So, what rule is applied?
Idhar.
Yes. Normally, pronounce the letter, the tanween. Sami'un alim. That's it. Next ayah, man dhaladhi. Mim, nun sakin plus dhal. Ikhfa, simply, yes? مَنْ ذَا الَّذِي يُقْرِضُ اللَّهَ. The letter dad, dal, ha, they are important. You have to pronounce them correctly. Qardan hasanan. Qardan, here tanween plus ha, idhar. But next one is ikhfa hasanan. Fayudha'ifahu lahu. Make sure you prolong it. Adha'afan. Ikhfa again. Adha'afan kathira. You can continue or stop here. Jim tells you this. Wallahu yaqbidu wa yabsutu. Aha. Qaf sakin, ba sakin, qalqala. Echoing sound, yes? Yaqbidu wa yabsutu. Here, do you see a sin on the top of Sad?
Yes.
It tells you that you can pronounce it both as sin. Both ways. Sad or sin, no problem. Okay?
Yes.
Yes. Wa ilayhi turja'un.
So it doesn't change the meaning.
No. So, guys, that was all about the tajweed rules here in these two verses. Thank you so much. We've mentioned the most important ones. Practice them well. For the tafsir points, refer to the tafsir books, okay? I give thanks to everyone who have been with us in this session, brothers and sisters, and also Fawad, Hassan, Hussein. See you, inshallah, in the coming sessions. Thanks to IRIB English Radio and several international schools for cooperations and holding this kind of Quranic session. See you, inshallah, in the coming sessions. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahu.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International School.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
The story of the sky.
Part 1.
From 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ until the late 20th century, about 14,500 wars have broken out and over 3 billion people have lost their lives due to wars. Only 300 years of history of mankind have actually passed in peace. This is what Conway Henderson says in his book. Ever since its emergence, the U.S. government has been a pioneer of wars all over the world by directly or indirectly waging wars in 37 countries. The current figures on the U.S. military conflicts after World War II show that Washington's so-called plans to expand liberty have sent 20 to 30 million people to their graves. This is why military experts believe that for every one person that's killed in any war, there are 10 more people injured. This means the U.S. has so far caused incidents similar to the 9/11 attacks 10,000 times in different parts of the world. looking into the U.S. background since its emergence, we don't see anything other than a bleak and bloody history of aggression, except for a few years. The fact of the matter is that West Asia was a focal point for the U.S. because of its strategic importance and the political geography and energy resources needed in the world. The U.S. military bases in the southern Persian Gulf littoral states, Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan, are proof. But there's only one reason for the U.S. presence in the region and its special attention to it, and that is Iran. In 1979, Iran shattered the political equations of the White House with its Islamic Revolution. Iran's progress during the eight-year war with Iraq, especially in its missiles industry, was beyond imagination, and it left the U.S. bewildered and, of course, worried more than any other country. Soon, Iranian missiles range reached the U.S. beating heart in the region, namely Tel Aviv. So, the alarm had now sounded for the Yankees to do something.
Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
On September 11th, 2001, the Twin Towers in New York collapsed after a fabricated scenario, and it paved the path for the U.S. to officially launch the military deployment to West Asia. So, the U.S. Army invaded Afghanistan on Sunday, October 7th, 2001, with its full military force. Two years later, on March 30th, 2003, the U.S. waged a new war in the region, with its military aggression against Iraq under the pretext of another unfounded claim that Saddam Hussein's regime was making weapons of mass destruction. Yet, despite all of this, the question is, why would the U.S. send its military forces thousands of miles away from home? That's why, after 2002, the Pentagon allocated a huge budget for construction, equipping, and expansion of ground, naval, and air bases in the Persian Gulf and adjacent regions. The U.S. has 21 bases in six Persian Gulf Arab states that are currently the largest bases to provide the U.S. troops in the region with facilities and equipment. Among the six Persian Gulf nations, Kuwait hosts six U.S. bases. Although it is a small base, it gives the U.S. the largest access for facilities in the region. After Kuwait, Qatar hosts the highest number of bases for the terrorist U.S. Army. Oman and the United Arab Emirates didn't want to be left behind, so they also handed over swaths of their land to the Yankees. The U.S. adventurism in the region shows that with hundreds of intelligence units on the ground and thousands of hours of drone flights, they are supposed to control the region in a way that they do not miss any event in the region. These are only a few examples of the reasons behind U.S. military presence with its full force in the region to counter Iran. Concurrent with the military campaign, they piled pressure on Iran through diplomatic means and impose missile and nuclear activities related sanctions to tighten the noose around the country. Iran's missile power would stop the U.S. from causing insecurity despite its muscle flexing in the region.
Every time I think about those kids.
That caused fury for the officials at the White House more than anything else. So they opted for the next option on the table. During all those years they were in Iraq, they churned out a new generation of murderers in the format of the Daesh terrorist group in their prisons, especially in Camp Buka, and triggered widespread bloodbaths and destruction in a large part of the region.
I call President Obama and Hillary Clinton the founders of ISIS. They're the founders. You get the MVP award. ISIS will hand her the most valuable player award. Her only competition is Barack Obama, between the two.
Muslims in the region, who were supposed to unite hands for the liberation of Palestine, were now at each other's throats after the accurately calculated scheme. So the occupied territories became a safer place for the Zionists. Costly arrangements in Iraq and Syria were made for the big cause, namely occupation of Iran. But they had overlooked this part of the plan. Reinforcing and reorganizing the formidable wall of the axis of resistance through the Islamic Republic of Iran's support. Anyways, the White House officials couldn't easily overcome the challenge, and the U.S. did not achieve a remarkable victory through this tactic either. Bearing the failures and Iran's invincibility had become harder for them. They decided to use Takfiri and MKO terrorist agents inside of Iran. Like their attacks on Iran's parliament, Imam Khomeini's shrine, and the army parade in Ahvaz. But it seems they had forgotten again that the fireworks would incur a huge wrath. The IRGC forces know full well what makes arrogant powers more enraged, so that's what they do against the enemies, so they'll taste the defeat more bitterly. Iran once again flaunted its missile power to the world, so they won't get any ideas about doing anything stupid. Now, in response to any aggression, Iran will level their bases to the ground with its ballistic missiles with pinpoint accuracy. After 8 years of destruction and cold-blooded carnage of civilians, Daesh had no achievement for the U.S. after the huge costs. And it meant a new hard defeat for the U.S. in its adventurism in West Asia.
$7 trillion. Not billion, not million. $7 trillion with a T. Nobody ever heard of the word trillion until 10 years ago. We spent $7 trillion in the Middle East.
The special images taken by IRGC Aerospace Forces experts from U.S. spy drones show the United States' all-out support for the terrorists in the region. The U.S. could not stand to see Iran's achievements against its terrorist groups. This time around, it bit off more than it could chew. Donald Trump's advisors had decided to revive the moribund maximum pressure campaign with a military shock. The best shock would be to eliminate one of the most important factors of the failure of U.S. policies in West Asia.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
At 1:20 a.m., Friday, January 3, 2020, something happened that shouldn't have.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani.
Trump, who was filled with fear, claimed responsibility for the attack. Yet, despite all of this, the gambler president threatened that in case Iran responded, 52 targets in Iran will be hit. The blatant rudeness had to be responded to quickly. Early morning on Wednesday, January 8th, 2020, at 1:20 a.m., 13 Qiyam and Fateh 313 ballistic missiles were fired from Kermanshah and destroyed a part of U.S. Ain al-Assad base located in the western Al Anbar province in Iraq.
IRIB English Radio.